You're listening to Awaken with Angus Ford Robertson, exploring humanity's greatest mystery, awakening through awareness. Hello, greetings and welcome. Angus here, and happily so. Gosh, it's been quite a break, huh? Those of you that have been pestering me since the end of season one, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the pestering, and it was a good nudge. I thought it was only going to be a few weeks break, of course, from season one to season two, but no, and lots of reasons why we needed more weeks, and more on that later. But anyway, we're here, episode one, season two. Let's begin. So season one was a deep dive, a deep exploration on stress, anxiety and panic attacks. And most importantly, I hope you'll agree, it was really an exploration of how do we move beyond it. Not just how does anxiety arise, but how do we move beyond it? How do we make a full recovery? So where are we headed over these next few weeks? Well, I'm absolutely thrilled to say that season two is going to be a series of interviews with a very special human being. Who is this person? Well, let me tease you a little bit. This person was an early investigator of human consciousness from the 60s. He was researching and studying and carrying out all sorts of investigations on the effects of meditation. He's written 10 plus, maybe 12 books on consciousness and the evolution of consciousness or human experience of consciousness. He originally studied physics at Cambridge University and was tutored by the one and only Stephen Hawking. And I could go on and on and on. I mean, there's a lot about this fellow. And he also happens to be a bloody good egg as well. I'm talking, of course, about Peter Russell. Some of you know him. We've been lucky enough to have him at Battersea Yoga Studio in the past. He's given talks and lectures and co-hosted retreats with him. So I'm absolutely thrilled that over the next few weeks, you'll be hearing interviews with Peter Russell. Oh, and before I forget, let me add that Pete's latest book, Letting Go of Nothing, is out and riding high on the charts. And that may be something to do with the fact that Eckhart Tolle, no less, is promoting it. Bless him. Well, good work, both of you, I say, Eckhart and Pete. So Eckhart is promoting Pete's latest book. He's written the foreword for it and is promoting it very heavily on the Eckhart Tolle site. So get that. Get you, Pete. Not jealous at all. Anyway, enough of this. Buy the book. It's blooming brilliant like all the other ones. And let's get down to business. So I'm not sure that I really need to do much of an intro to this conversation that we got into, other than to say, as every conversation I've had with Pete, it's fascinating, it's illuminating, he makes difficult things sound simple. Where we head, of course, is, a few little light questions like, what is the ego? What is consciousness? What the heck do we actually know about anything ever? I then take him down a little rabbit hole of where do thoughts come from? And then he also tells us a bit about his book, Letting Go of Nothing. It's just lovely. He's lovely. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Let's have a listen. It feels quite indulgent being in this chair, Pete. I'm sort of all, I'm in the proper chair, I'm supported, I've got the cans on. No, I think this first issue that's coming up around ego feels spot on. So if I can just start by saying, it feels like everyone in the world, in the spiritual world, has a slightly different take on ego, Pete. That's my feeling on it. And I think it can get very confusing for a lot of people out there to really know where they stand. What does ego mean? I mean, Freud had a take. Eckhart definitely has a take. Everyone's got a slightly different slant. So I would love to know, where are you on ego? What is it? What does it mean to you? Tell us.
Right. Okay. Yes, you're right. There's many, many different slants. And the way I see it is, well, first of all, ego isn't a thing. There isn't an ego. We talk about an ego or my ego or a person, another person's ego, like it's some thing that's there. But when I actually, look inside myself, I don't find a separate part of me. People talk about the ego as a separate self. I don't find a separate self that's called ego. I find my sense of self, my sense of being, the I that's there. And I find what I might call sort of egocentric thought patterns or feelings. So that there's an egocentricity there, but the ego itself doesn't exist as a thing or an inner entity that's there that's running me, but it's thought patterns. That's why I say it. And the basic mindset behind, I think, the ego is what do I need to keep myself safe and secure? Basically, I think it comes back to our biology. It's like that fundamentally we want to survive, and it's an ego mode of thinking. That comes from that. It's basic survival, whether it's biological survival, social, psychological survival. It's all about how can we preserve ourselves in some way or other. So it's a mode of thinking, it's a mindset, it's a mode of thinking. And why I like that myself is it means that we don't get rid of ego like it's something we get rid of, like, which is how it's often seen. The ego is an enemy that we need to battle and get rid of. It's actually fundamentally, it's trying to help us. It's trying to help us get by in life. But 90% of the time, it's inappropriate, not needed, and it's almost like get behind me, ego. I sometimes say, when I notice it, thanks, but right now you're not really helping either of us. So it's something we can step out of. And so we can step out of it every time we notice it arising, rather than years and years of meditation, you will eventually defeat the ego. It's like, no, any moment of our life, any moment of the day, when we notice ourselves caught in that mode of thinking, we can just say, okay, thank you, but let us come back to me here. Yeah, that's how I see it.
I get it totally. I've got a question for you on this, so it's actually just come up as you were saying all that, because I get the piece about survival, and I'm totally in agreement. You and I have touched on this over the years. The survival piece, yes, we identify with the thoughts, that is the ego, we grip onto this thing. Now, there's one situation where it seems like it's maybe at odds with that model, which is where we're attached to being angry with someone, or we're self-righteous, or being a bit of a dick or pompous, and it's like, well, hold on. I thought it was there to for survival. How, what, why is that happening?
Well, I think it's still survival. It's more a sort of personal survival in the sense of, who I am, I'm important, I'm more righteous or whatever. And so, that person's a dick, which means I'm better in
Yes.
some way or another. And the feeling of I'm better is like reinforcing my sense of who I am in the world. So it's like survival of my social identity, or you could call it something like that, that's going on. So it's not just about physical survival.
I get it, and I
Right?
totally get it, but I think there's a distinction here between real survival, and obviously the mind and the brain is really invested. It is a survival mechanism. It wants the organism to survive. But the ego is in the survival of a false, aggrandized, non-existent, non-real entity,
Yes.
which is actually self-defeating.
Absolutely, yes.
So we do have a slight dichotomy here.
Well, I don't think it's, it's obviously not all about, survival in the physical sense. Let's see. Just say it again, the last bit you were saying again.
Well, it's just around. So if we're totally in agreement that fundamentally the ego is there as a survival mechanism, we have the capacity to think. We're also fully in agreement that our attachment to thinking is the problem. That's you know, when we start to work on spiritual issues and see that we have to separate from the thoughts. They're not my thoughts. They're just conditioned, inherited patterns. Now, so completely on the same page with you through all of that. I'm sort of just a bit tickled by this slightly curious anomaly that while the ego is fundamentally there for survival, it's also curiously there because it's maintaining a false image, a false self. It's actually self-defeating because it leads to such suffering and such, well, in the worst case scenario, it can lead to self-destruction. If we are that, you know, take the Hollywood Hollywood A-lister who's got this idea of themselves on this, you know, sexy rock and roll lifestyle, cocaine, motorbikes, girls, whatever it might be, and it destroys them. Hold on, I thought you were saying it was, you know, not you, one.
I totally get you, and this is the reason why I think we should be vigilant against the ego mode, because... It's that way of thinking gets then hijacked and applied to other situations where it's totally inappropriate. And yes, it's not in our best interest. I would actually say most of the time, the ego mode is not in our best interest. It causes us to, you know, maybe say things in a relationship that are not actually that helpful, to do things that are not helpful. It takes us over. It's in this mode of thinking is in control. And I would probably say in control, you know, 80-90% of the time. Yeah. And it's totally counterproductive in those situations. Totally.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good response. Thank you. It's I suppose it's just curious because it is fundamentally there for survival, and yet when it gets out of control, it's really detrimental to our survival.
Right. Maybe I would actually, maybe survival is too strong a word. I mean, that's where it comes from initially. Mm-hmm. But I think I prefer safe, keeping us safe and secure. So it's trying to look after us. It's trying to look after us. So survival is, yes, that's where it goes back to biologically. But it's just it's trying to look after us. It's trying to make sure our lives are okay, our lives work out, that, you know, people like us, that we get done what we want to get done, that we actually, we continue in this world on a comfortable path.
That's
what it's trying to do.
Yes. Beautiful. Now, this leads, Pete, into... the natural segue, which is the ongoing discussion, consciousness. Who wrote the book Conscious? Who was it? It was someone's, can't remember. Do you know the book Conscious? It was written?
Not well. I've heard of it, but I don't know it.
A little while back. Yes, it'll come to me shortly. I'll try and remember it. But she wrote, she's a journalist, but she wrote a good, decent piece, a sort of a 2-hour, 3-hour read on the history of humanity's understanding or beliefs in consciousness. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me fundamentally that there's only really two ways of viewing consciousness. Either that, and of course, I want to hear what your thoughts are on this, either that it arises somehow mysteriously with the origination of organic material, you know, the embryo grows and mysteriously there is consciousness there. So that's model A. Or model B, there is consciousness and we are in this perhaps sea of consciousness. We are physical form arising in and experiencing consciousness. So as I understood it, it was a couple of years since I read it, but that was the gist. That was the dichotomy before us.
Right.
Tell us, where are you at with this? You've had a long time to think about this.
Right. In some ways, I'm not with either of them. I know they're the two standard views.
Okay.
But, you know, you say conscious, you know, we somehow experience consciousness. Hang on. What do we mean when we say we experience consciousness? We are conscious of consciousness. You know, it's like to say we experience consciousness is assuming that consciousness exists somehow separate from our experience. But it is what we experience with. And I think part of the problem here is we use the word as a noun. And I think as soon as we use the word as a noun, we get into trouble. And I think that's in all the scientific research and a lot of the philosophical stuff. It's all talking about this thing called consciousness. Now, when you add N-E-S-S to any word, you're taking an adjective and turning it into a noun so that you can talk about it. But the noun doesn't exist. I mean, like happiness, we talk about happiness. Happiness isn't a thing that exists. Being happy definitely is an experience we know. And so being conscious, what we're talking about is the fact that we are conscious, and that we all know for sure. For the one thing we know for sure is that we are conscious, we are aware, we have experiences. And so that's the way I tend to look at it. It's like, we don't need to define consciousness or really work out, you know, does it come from matter or not? The first step is to come back and recognize this is my fundamental reality in experience. In terms, that's how I see it. In terms of why does this inner reality of experience exist in the universe? I think that's more the question. Why is there this inner reality of being aware? Who knows? I have spent years writing about it, giving keynote speeches on it at conferences.
Good work if you can get it, Pete. Good work.
It was. And then about 3-4 years ago, I had this sort of awakening. Like, what the fuck do I know? Mm-hmm. I could be very good at arguing my side of the debate, and I could, you know, I could, other people who had their side, I could see why they were wrong. I could argue against them very cogently. And I think that's why I got quite popular, because I could really make my case strongly and clearly and logically, etc. And then, what the fuck do I know? And so I've actually stopped talking about that subject in terms of, you know, does it come out of matter? Or does it emerge from matter? Does it pre-exist? Is the whole universe conscious? Is it? And is it there as a sort of proto-consciousness in all things? I really don't know what the answer is. There was a very interesting article I was reading a couple of days ago, New Scientist, which was posing another theory of consciousness, which was, it was all about, I won't go into it, it's all about events rather than things. I thought, oh yes, that's interesting. And my sort of argument in my, but what they're not seeing is this. So,
Yeah. Yes, you remind me of a recording, beautiful, slightly charming recording of Osho from years ago, where, oh boy, did he make the point about the word why. There is no, he said, no human has ever answered the why. There is no, we think we answer why, you know, brainy boffin scientists, you know, we know why photosynthesis happens and we know why the stars. He says, no, we don't. We don't friggin' know why any of it. We are answering sometimes what is happening and our best model of how it's happening. Right. We have never, ever, ever answered why. We don't know why plants turn sunlight and this into that and that. And, you know, we just don't know.
we assume there is a why. We go looking for it. It may be just, this is the universe unfolding. This is it unfolding. And all this stuff. Why it unfolds? I think it's one of these questions we shouldn't even ask, because there's a basic assumption behind it that there's some purpose we are trying to discover.
I like to, I'd be curious to know what you think of this, or whether this model works in any way, shape or form. I'm quite a fan of observing what we humans do and the things we've created, particularly in the last century, and then seeing how that is a reflection of another more natural, let's say more, universal principle. Take the humble transistor radio and waves, and it has an aerial and it can pick up the waves. It doesn't make any music. It doesn't have an orchestra in the radio, but it is an entity that can pick up a signal, a greater, grander signal, and transmit it. And I wonder how that applies to the human brain and thoughts and consciousness.
Right. I mean, the question you're pointing to is like, does the human brain pick up information from beyond this actual body?
Only completely, yes. You see, I'm not really a believer anymore that I make thoughts.
Right. We don't. Thoughts appear. Thoughts occur. Yes.
And could this be the radio? He says, tapping his head.
Well, I don't see it that way. Maybe we are seeing it the same way. But I come back to there's perception going on all the time. So that's coming in through our senses, and so we create this image of a world out there, and we have language. And we talk to ourselves inside as well, which I think is a lot of thinking is coming from that. Where that comes from, I think, is our needs. Partly we were talking about the ego earlier. The ego mind has a lot of agendas, and a lot of our thinking gets caught up in the ego mind. So I see thoughts are arising in ourselves from unconscious needs, wishes, etc., or stimulus. The other day I caught myself, I saw this unusual bird in the garden. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, what is that bird? And it's like, I suddenly realized, hang on, there's this beautiful bird here. I don't know what its name is. Who cares? Let me just enjoy the bird. But just how stimulus in the environment can trigger thoughts is that bit of me that wants to know, wants to understand, which is great, but hang on, you're getting in the way of me actually enjoying this unusual bird. So I don't know, but go on. I mean, does that fit in at all with what you're talking about, or are you talking about something else?
Well, no, that's there's tons of avenues from this. I mean, to your last point, of course, Krishnamurti famously said that, didn't he? He said about the bird, exactly. I think he said, teach the child the name of the bird and it'll never see the same, that it'll never see the bird again, which was a rather beautiful observation to your to your last point. But I think where I'm heading with the radio and the orchestra transmission and so on analogy is, I don't know that I don't feel convinced that we are originating our own thoughts, that we are in a field and we are collectively. I mean, we see it, of course, at the beginning of a nationalist movement or a war or whatever. Millions of people, or at a football match, can turn on a dime. And the mind can pick up on a frequency and an idea and get behind something. Isn't there a thing called the 100th monkey syndrome, where sort of monkeys learn things?
Yes, that was Lyle Watson got on that bandwagon. Yeah. Actually misrepresented the data.
Okay. But I think the prior point still, for me, Stan, that we have a sort of collective consciousness and a collective thinking that can happen. I think we've also just seen it 2 years ago with a pandemic and government messaging. So I suppose I'm just putting a big fat question mark over the uniqueness and individuality of thoughts, or whether it is actually mass frequencies, vibration signals that we tend to pick up on things.
Yeah. Who knows?
But what I do know,
I certainly sympathise with that point of view, and it may that way may well be something that's going on and on some sort of collective consciousness level. I do sense that, and it feels like things are going that way. That's how it feels, and ultimately, I don't know. But yes, I get what you're saying.
Well, And you've written about it in, and I shall be plugging your books fiercely at the on the intro to these recordings. But the one that I loved, he says now, trying to remember which one of the two you wrote this in, but where you were talking about the internet and the birth of the internet and how this reflected this global interconnected thinking. Now, just before you add and respond to this, can I say, I'm aware that as humans, we create stuff that is the mirror of reflection, if you like, of what we are. You know, almost everything we create is a fractal expanded out there, if you get my gist. You know, we have a fist and then we can create a hammer. Oh, that's a better hammer. There we are. Everything's a magnification. And it seemed to me when you were making this point beautifully in the book that there is some interconnected bigger brain. Was it in Global Brain or was it in
it was the Global Brain. Whole? Actually, in England, it was published as The Awakening Earth was the English title. It was the Global Brain in America. Yeah, it was there. That's what And that's what I was suggesting, hypothesizing. And that was 40 years ago, remember?
Right. Well, yeah. Good on you. Amazing.
I was a lot more certain back then.
But it seems to be this radio signal orchestra idea.
Yes. What I was suggesting there was that there was something, a collective consciousness arising beyond human beings through the internet. The parallel I was drawing was how the brain develops and how the internet, even back then before it was called the internet, how the network of computers was growing. And I could see parallels between the way the brain developed and the way the internet was developing and now has developed. And it's been amazing to watch that over the last 40 years. Mm. And so I was hypothesizing that just as, you know, our own brain activity gives rise to my particular set of experiences, if you say consciousness, if you like, would the same thing be happening on a planet? Mm. Would it be happening on a planetary level? And would we actually know about it? And I was thinking, well, does a nerve cell in my brain, you know, if we get the hypothesis it is conscious in some way, does it know about the collective consciousness of all the billions of nerve cells in my brain, the collective consciousness that I call me? Does it know about that? Maybe not. But how would it? I was saying, but it would notice the effects of it, because it would notice a sort of synergy effect that things could actually go better. If there's consciousness there, things would go better for the whole organism, etc. And so it might notice coincidences happening. And so I was hypothesizing that if this were developing, then what we'd notice would be more synchronicities, more coincidences happening in our life. And it could be, well, you know, I think what you're saying is, well, is there also a collect? Are we tuned into each other and a greater field?
Yes.
I think we probably are. I think we probably are. It feels that way.
It does to me. And I'm sort of excited to hear you say that, Pete. Now, listen, I'm conscious of time. I've genuinely got now about 20 more questions, not just 5 more. So we are going to continue this and hopefully make it a series. But before you go, can you give me a little synopsis of the new book that I'm thrilled to see that Eckhart is promoting wildly in the States? Your new book is out and riding high. Tell us name, title, premise, and why we need to buy it, please.
Right. You need to buy it so that your life will be happier, better, more feel better and more alive. And
it makes you sexy.
You're more awake. Maybe that as well.
Good. Glad we cleared that up.
You'll stop smoking and lose weight.
Great. There you go.
And maybe a few other things I haven't thought of at the moment. Okay. It's called Letting Go of Nothing, which is a deliberately provocative title. But the reason behind that is, we think about letting go. We think, I've got to let go of this relationship. I've got to let go of, you know, my money or something, or I've got to let go of even, you know, this emotion that's there. Even those are like mental things. We're not actually letting go of things. What we're letting go of always is a way of seeing things. Mm. We're letting go of a mindset. We're letting go of how we see things. Like if it's a relationship, we have a certain way in which we're seeing that relationship and what it means or doesn't mean or all that. So we're letting go of a way of seeing the relationship. And the way of seeing something isn't a thing we actually experience. Like if you put on blue glasses, you see the world as blue, but you don't see blue glasses everywhere. And it's the same thing. The way we see the world is something that is behind all our experience. It's a mindset which conditions our experience. And so it's a no thing. That's sort of the pun. What we're letting go of is a no thing, which is right. the way we see things. Mm. What it's about, it's a personal account of my own exploration of letting go over my life, which has been a theme ever since I first started getting interested in meditation, since I realized letting go was important. And over the years, it's just come more and more to the fore as the essence of things. And almost every spiritual tradition talks about letting go in one way or another, whether it's about, you know, renunciation of material things or forgiveness, which is really letting go, whatever it is, surrendering to the divine, letting go is there. And what I've come up with over my own journey is a sort of reframing of letting go. It isn't something we do. I think that's one of the mistakes we make. We think I have to do the letting go. It's something and people say, I tried to let go, but I couldn't do it. Mm. I've reframed it for myself and just found this really helpful is, first of all, it's about letting be, as many people, including the Beatles, have said,
yeah,
let it be. And many other teachers have said, you know, let it be, let it be. But then I realized before I could let anything be, I had to actually let it in, to actually let in, you know, let in my resistance, my frustration, or whatever it is, or if it's, you know, anger, to let that in, or if it's, you know, my attitude to in a relationship or to money, whatever it is, to allow in the holding on, allow in the experience of holding on, how it feels in the body, what are all the thoughts behind it, and then I have something to let be. But otherwise, letting be is just like, oh, I'm not going to let it be means, oh, I'm not going to think about it. You know, I need to let go of that relationship. Just let it be. Mm. It isn't just letting it be. It's first of all, getting in touch with what's going on in you around it and bringing that to the surface. And then by letting it be, you're not resisting it anymore. And what I found myself is it's the resistance to things that gets in the way. And when you can drop the resistance, then the letting go becomes a lot easier.
So that concludes episode one, the first interview with Pete Russell. Please forgive my somewhat abrupt edit at the end there. But as you'll hear next week in episode two, the conversation takes a surprising and rather fascinating turn, and I didn't want to run over too long on this episode. So I hope you'll join us next week. I hope you've enjoyed this week. Till then, wishing you well. You've been listening to Awaken with Angus Ford Robertson. To join my Awaken program, please visit angusfordrobertson.com.